Good morning. If you'd like to turn in your Bibles to John chapter 2, John chapter 2. I will also put in a cell for the yellow involvement forms that we're trying to collect. I would give you more of a guilt cell as soon as I've turned my own in. So maybe next week I'll lay it on a little heavier, but as for now, those would be really helpful to get in. I know we are counting through all those things. Denise has been working really hard in the office to get all those into a spreadsheet of usable information so that you will actually have something happen with those. So you're not just doing busy work, I assure you. And if you think to yourself, I've been here for 40 years and I remember the old building and all that kind of stuff, we still need one from you just to update things and make sure we've got everything right. So from the newest members to the ones that have been here forever, we could really use that information. It would be a lot of help. So fill that out and fill up our red box so we don't have to start naming names, which I'm more free to do once I've filled my own out. So John chapter 2. I was told before we got married that I would not remember much about the wedding, that it would all be kind of this just jumble of activity in a day, and there would be so much tension and pressure and all this stuff that I wouldn't remember much about it. The wedding planning was pretty complex, at least my wife tells me that. I was there to show up, that was my job, and occasionally having opinions, and if you knew me very well, probably have opinions at the wrong times when I was not supposed to have the opinions. But my wife and her mom and some of her family put an awful lot of work into this wedding that took place. And I remember leading into it, hearing, like I said, again and again, you're not going to remember this stuff. And I found the opposite, for the most part, that there are lots of neat little funny moments within the wedding that I remember really well. Now, first of all, I remember we did the pictures ahead of time. We did the pictures early before everybody got there, for the most part. There were some taken during the service, too, but all those, the group of bridesmaids and the group of groomsmen and families and all that stuff, we did ahead of time. But we also were traditional, by the way, because we loved our guests. We didn't want to make them wait between the end of it and just stare at a cake for a half hour while we're taking pictures. But we were traditional enough that we wanted to have that seeing the bride for the first moment thing that you're supposed to have at a wedding. And so we set up the pictures in that way where everyone was up front as they would be, and the back doors of the college church opened up, and there is my wife. And I remember very vividly, or my wife-to-be at that point, I remember very vividly having this thought in my head of, how in the world did I pull this off, first of all? But secondly, just thinking, everything I thought that moment could be, it was more. And there's a picture of me at the moment that the doors open that's one of my wife's favorites, because it's just this look on my face of, wow, I can't believe how this has all come together. The next thing that I remember from the wedding, very vividly, is we lit the unity candle. Now, those of you who are getting married nowadays don't know how good you have it, because it used to be much more ceremonial. Everybody had to go rent a tux. Now everybody's wearing like khakis and white shirts untucked, and I'm just jealous every time I see it because I rented so many tuxes. We had the unity candle, and everyone warned us ahead of time that the unity candle will not light. It's just what happens at weddings, and those of you who have been to weddings with the unity candle, you've seen this happen. And so what we were told ahead of time is, light it before everything starts so you have a candle that has been lit instead of a candle that is brand new because it doesn't want to light. So we did. And so we went up there, and there's a song going during the unity candle, and we lit the candle, and the candle lit within about 5 seconds the way it should. But the thing we didn't think about is, well, if the candle lights within 5 seconds, we now have 3 minutes and 48 seconds of song to stand there and look at each other awkwardly as everyone's just watching and nothing's going on. And it was just very, I remember that well. I remember getting into the vows and you have in sickness and in health and rich and poor and all this stuff. And somewhere in the midst of that was in sharing all your worldly possessions. And at that point, my wife begins to laugh. And out loud enough that it caught the preacher off guard and he stopped for a minute. Because in her mind, her worldly possessions, she's imagining the 13-inch TV at her house that still has the dial tuners on the front of it, that you can watch either in shades of red, green, or blue, depending on the show you want to and you'd adjust. Then we got to the rings. And our ring bearer, who was just this great little kid from my wife's family, I don't remember how old he was at the time, but he was told his job was he was responsible for the ring. And when it came time for the ring, I turned to my best man, who I've known since we were 13, and he comes up to hand me the ring and fakes tripping on the step. And what I don't know is he has gone to the dollar store and bought a package of fake rings. He has about 50 of them in his hand. And as he fakes the trip and drops 50 rings on the floor, and you see the ring bearer go, and his eyes get big and his jaw drops and he doesn't know what to do, and everyone laughs, and it's this funny kind of moment. And I think through the wedding, and there are all these neat little moments that come along through it. There's the moment that as we leave and everyone is pelting us with rice for whatever crazy traditional reason, that I chivalrously just took off for the car, leaving my wife to get pelted with rice. All kinds of funny things that happen. And I think of the story we'll look at in John chapter 2 today. Now, the wedding in the ancient Near East is a little different than what we would experience, but yet there are a lot of similarities. We see beginning in verse 1 of chapter 2, on the third day, a wedding took place in Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. Now, the wedding was this week-long celebration a lot of times, and it might just be a few days depending on the amount of money involved, but a lot of times there would be this wedding feast that just went on and on and on. I immediately think of us here. We like to eat here at the Eugene Church of Christ. If you're visiting, this might be one of those rare times where there's not stuff out there, but usually people bring stuff from their gardens and people bring food to share, and especially Sunday night and Wednesday night, if you're not a Sunday night, Wednesday night person, there's a lot of that stuff, and there's always some kind of treat out there, it seems like. In these weddings, they would have these feasts that would go on for days and days. We see also that Jesus and his mother and his disciples are invited to the wedding. Now, I know it's hard when we go through these stories that we've heard lots of times, and for a lot of you, this is a really familiar one, not to skip ahead in our minds because we know what's going to happen here down the road. But there are a lot of folks, as we look into this story, that feel like they run out of wine because here are Jesus and his disciples and it's all these extra people, but yet at the beginning, we kind of gloss over the fact that they're invited guests too. There is this plan for them to be there. And the fact that they're invited tells you a number of things. I'm going to guess in Jesus' day, there was not the church bulletin that Denise had put together during the week, and you did not have these, when weddings come along, everyone is invited to this wedding. There was a lot more planning involved, and if you were invited to this wedding, it was because you were close somehow. You're a close friend, you're a relative, and so there is some connection here between Jesus and his disciples and this wedding couple. There is also some kind of a connection with Jesus' mother. So there's probably a family connection of some kind because she is there. And she doesn't pop up a lot in the Gospel of John. But here she is at this wedding. Some other things we might not know about weddings back in this day and time. This feast would go on at the bridegroom's home. So the men are not off the hook in this day and time. They have to do a lot of planning for these wedding feasts that come along. Something else that I was interested reading through some commentaries looking at this chapter. Did you know that virgins would be married on Wednesdays and widows would be married on Thursdays? Just an interesting little fact about the wedding back then, but there were these different plans that they would go into. They were invited to come along, so they're probably friends and family. And then we get to verse 3. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." Now, this is probably a good time to take a quick tangent. We went to Corvallis yesterday to a men's thing. I drove through Tangent. I was excited. I got to go off on a tangent in the church van or in our car. Here's a little tangent for this story. This is not a story about what we should assume about alcohol. And I know people like to jump to this story anytime we get into these discussions about social drinking and all that. Not the purpose of this story. This story is about a sign that Jesus is going to do. This story is about a family get-together. It's any number of things. We're not going to go into social drinking today, and we could do that at another time and what we think about it, but if you're wanting to think social drinking, this is not the purpose of the story. Now, what the story is any number of other things. They ran out of wine. They have no more wine, and Jesus says to his mother, "Dear woman, why do you involve me?" Seems a little abrupt, doesn't it? Just to refer to his mother as woman. We had at our house, anytime I hear this now, we had at our house this little kid. His name was Seth. He came to visit. His older brother went to Harding. And he came to visit, and he stayed with my wife and our kids at the house while his parents were going off to some meeting about financial aid or something like that. And we found out during the course of that week that Seth, who was probably in kindergarten or maybe even pre-K at that point, his brothers were sophomores in high school and then one going into college. Seth was a surprise somewhere along the way. And Seth, because of this, so much of his interaction was with teenagers and people about to be college students. And so life for Seth was interesting at times, I would imagine. And some kids had taught Seth, some of the 10th grade friends of some of his brothers had taught Seth to go into his kitchen one day where his mom was and to walk up to her and say, "Woman, make me a sandwich." Now, if you could imagine, some of you are laughing, some of you are recoiling in horror at this point. If you could imagine the reaction, and it was one of those shocked moments for his mom, and at the same time, she knew it was the high school kids out in the other room that had put him up to it. And so when he's at my house, he at one point goes up to my wife and says, "Woman, make me a sandwich." And she says to him, "I'm going to tell your mother you said that." And he immediately is fearful and says, no, don't tell my mom. And so when I see woman here in this reference to Mary, I start to think it's kind of abrupt. And if you have the NIV, if you're reading from the NIV, you will see dear woman. And what that is, very honestly, is the people translating the NIV back in the early 70s thought this sounded really bad. And they said, maybe if we say dear woman, people won't be quite as put off by it, so we'll throw dear in there. Bible translators do that every now and then, and sometimes it's frustrating, and sometimes they assume a little too much. But they were trying to soften the blow because of our culture. Now, what we don't see here is, this. It seems abrupt to us because of the world and time that we live in. In this time, not so much. And we will see Jesus use this one other time when he looks at his mother and says, "Woman," and that's as he hangs on the cross. And he looks at Mary and he says, "Woman, behold your son. And son, behold your mother." And that is we've never looked at that, I don't think, and thought abrupt. We've never looked at that and thought rude. We've looked at that and thought, here's a man who in his dying moments is caring about his mother. And so take abruptness out of it for a minute. Now, the more literal way that this might be translated is something along the lines of, "What is this to you and me?" Or maybe the way we might think of it is, "What is important to you is not necessarily important to me." Now, again, depending on how we look at it, that might sound a little bit abrupt, but in a lot of ways, that's how we carry on with life most of the time. There are things that really matter to me, and there are things that really matter to you, and sometimes those roads cross, and other times they don't. And sometimes we will make decisions based on those things, and sometimes not so much. We were at the men's thing yesterday, and we were going to eat dinner on the way out of town, and we had found that there was a Sherry's and an Elmer's that Mike commented, same menu, basically. And so we could go to one of those places, and on the way the GPS was leading us, it passed us by the Ruby Tuesday, which you will now learn is one of my favorite places in the world. And so I said, "Oh, look, there's a Ruby Tuesday." And in my mind, I'm thinking, similar menu, kind of, but this will make my day and they probably won't care. And so let's go to Ruby Tuesday. And we went and it was good and all was well. And I thought to myself, what is a big deal to me? Maybe not so much to you. Jesus was seeing this through a different prism. And God sees our lives, I think, a lot of times through a prism that is not the one that we look through. That's a hard thing for us to get our heads around because we've got mapped out in mind what it is we're going to do and where it is we want to go. We have in our minds what's important and what's not, and sometimes what God has to say is not the same. And so Jesus' mother says to him, they're out of wine, and he says, "What is it to me and what is it to you?" Now, I think I'm behind a slide here. The question that comes to mind is, what did Mary expect to happen? And I think there will be some that will read this story and assume Mary expects something miraculous. Now, we don't know much about what Jesus did from childhood on. We have, he's born, and there's a lot of incredible things that happen there, and we have the story where he goes to the temple, and then there's just a lot of nothing for a while, And then he shows up and he's baptized and he goes through temptation, and then here he is at this wedding. There are traditions out there that say Jesus every now and then does something unbelievable growing up. If you've seen The Passion of the Christ, there are moments where Jesus, if I remember right, it's been a while since I've seen the movie, he encounters a bird that's dead on the road, and he picks it up, and then it flies away. I don't know if Jesus had those moments or not. I like to think so because it sounds kind of cool, but we don't really know. So could Mary be expecting something miraculous? Sure. Now, something we do figure out about Jesus that I think we can all agree on is he seems to be a pretty resourceful guy. And so maybe it's just Mary sees a problem, and these are family friends or maybe even family, and she wants to be helpful, and Jesus is the guy who knows how to do that. And so maybe she looks at Jesus thinking he'll have some solution to this problem. We don't know. We don't know what she expects, but what we do know is the command that she gives. And that is, do whatever he tells you. And if you want to know what the story is about, it's not about social drinking, it's not about funny things that happen at weddings, it's not about all that stuff. It is about this sentence right here. Do whatever he tells you. How much of life could be made easier if all of us would hear this morning? Just do whatever he tells you. How much of our world would operate more smoothly if it was, do whatever he tells you? Ron talked about death this morning as we were having our communion time. How much death that goes on in the world that is because people are upset with other people or don't understand other people, how many of those things could be fixed by do whatever he tells you? And I don't know what Mary knew about Jesus at this point. Clearly she knows that his birth was miraculous. Clearly she knows he's not like all the other kids. Clearly she knows he's a resourceful guy. Maybe she's seen miracles, maybe she hasn't. But what she does know is if you do what he tells you to do, something good is going to happen here. So she says, do whatever he tells you. So nearby stood six stone water jars in verse 6, the kind used by the Jews, for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, fill the jars with water. So they filled them to the brim. Now, why fill them with water? I have no idea. Now, I have thoughts of what maybe is the reason here. And probably number one up on that list is there's something about the people present knowing what they put into the jar and seeing something else come out of the jar that maybe makes a little more of an impact. Now, there are also theories here that we find that the wine is good when it gets to the guy who tastes the wine. Some people think that the miracle happens at the point that Jesus has them pour the water in. Some people think it's as they draw it out. Some people think that they are taking water to the guy and then it's wine as it gets to him. We don't know the exact point along the way, and we can get caught up in that. But wherever it is along the way, it becomes wine. And again, we're not having an alcohol discussion right now, but he turns this water into wine, and then they take it to the guy who is in charge, and he tries it, and he finds out this stuff is amazing. And we see something here about this first sign that Jesus does. And I know as you guys read through John earlier in the year, you saw these signs that Jesus did. Here he has this power over created things, and he turns water into wine, and we see a few things. First of all, we see it's a big amount. And he could very easily just make a small amount of wine and try to make that the point of what's going on. My wife taught the toddler class at the church we came from. And when they came to Jesus turning water to wine, I don't remember exactly how she did it, but she had water that she poured into something that had a little bit of food coloring or Kool-Aid or something like that in it. And toddlers are amazed as it suddenly goes from clear to red and water has turned to wine and they don't know what to make of that. But Jesus does this in such quantities that you just can't deny that something unbelievable has happened here. The second thing he does is his miracles are not just good enough. What does that mean to us? Heaven is not going to be just slightly better than earth is. Heaven is not going to be Eugene with less traffic. Heaven is not going to be Eugene with just a few less days of rain or a couple less days in the 90s. Where the smoke doesn't settle in, or whatever you think of the thing you'd like to change. Heaven is going to be something that is far beyond anything we can imagine. And we don't get blown away much anymore with something. It's hard to surprise somebody. It's hard when we have these lists of things we want. I remember one of the Christmases early on, we handed the Target toy catalog that came in the mail to our kids and said, would you circle the things in here you might like for Christmas? And we got back a Target toy catalog that had everything that was not pink circled. And we thought, we can't really keep up with this. We don't know what to do. And it was hard to surprise them because of all the different things that they wanted. But those times where you could, those times where it was something that was just above and beyond, and you remember that look on their face, heaven is far beyond what we can imagine. A life where we do what it is he tells us to do is far beyond what we can imagine. And so when the guy in charge of this wedding feast gets that wine that has been drawn from these jars and tastes it, it's not what he imagines. And part of why it's not is we read that, if you want to continue on in verse 8, he told him, draw some of the water, take it to the master of the banquet. They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned to wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, everyone brings out the choice wine first and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink, but you have saved the best until now. They bring out the cheaper stuff later after everybody's had too much. Some will think that's because their palate is messed up at that point. Some will think that because they're getting a little tipsy at that point, however you want to interpret that verse. But they bring out the lesser later when the expectations are lower, when the judgment is not quite the same. And Jesus does not operate in that way. Jesus, we see, saved the best for last. And it is hard to have that perspective. I imagine as this wedding is going on and they realize they've run out of wine and Mary gets Jesus involved in it, maybe to save the wedding folks from embarrassment, whatever it might be, that there is a little bit of panic that has set in with everyone who's there, who's in charge, because they've run out, and that you just don't do that. I was a youth minister for 10 years, and we would have this event at the beginning of every school year where we welcome the new seventh graders. And much like the yellow sheets we're trying desperately to get everybody like me to fill out, people didn't come to that meeting. Seventh graders would come, and they were pretty excited, but getting their parents there was something else. And so we figured out we need to have good food at this meeting, and that will draw people in. And so we started having better food at the meeting instead of the pizzas we normally had for youth group stuff, and people started coming to the meeting. And there was one year where we would expect to get maybe half of the parents that were there, all of them showed up. And there was an incoming class of seventh graders, it was 10 or 12 kids, and all of their parents showed up, and we were running out of food, and I was panicking because I thought, this is my responsibility. These people who have been in a panic and not expecting anything other than just something, hopefully to tide everybody over, something that will be okay. In our desperation, we sent somebody to Little Caesars because they're hot and ready. It wasn't the best food of the night, but it was food. It was something. Jesus doesn't operate that way. He saves the best. And God does the same. And in all of our perspective that we lose it sometimes, and we get so caught up in what's happening today and everything that we've got to do today, we forget that the best is being saved for us later on down the road. Everyone brings out the choice wine first, then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink, but you have saved the best till now. This, the first of his miraculous signs, Jesus performed at Cana in Galilee. He thus revealed his glory, and his disciples put their faith in him. Now, there are a couple purposes in the story. One, I really think, are Mary's words, which is just do what he tells you to do. And the second is that this is done not for good drinks at a wedding. This is not done just primarily so people won't be embarrassed or be thirsty, but it's a sign. It's something that will begin to point people towards who Jesus is and who God is, and something that we can learn from as a result of that. Now, does God give us signs today? I don't know. I think we look for them and want them sometimes. And sometimes it's hard to argue as to what is and what isn't. But I think God does try very hard to direct us if we will open our eyes and look for him. God is alive and working in our lives today. And he wants the best for us. He has saved the best for us. And we think too many times of that in worldly terms. But he wants something so much greater for us than that. This morning, we want you to be a part of that too. We want you to see the best that has been saved for us. We want you to know that there is more to life than just the junk that you're going to go through this week, the things that you're struggling with. There's something that is so much greater than that. And that we serve a God who does not stop with just good enough. We serve a God that wants us to have a reward with him that is so much greater than anything we can imagine. This morning, if you'd like to take him on in baptism for the first time, if you would like to confess sins that you're struggling with, if you would like to have us pray with you, or if you just need to get your life back on track and live it in such a way that shows that you know that the best is still to come, whatever your needs are, please come as we stand and sing.